Welcome to The Workplace, a podcast by Kell Chamber. I'm Erica Frank, Kell Chamber's General Counsel and Executive Vice President. And today on the podcast, we will be discussing the Department of Labor's updated guidelines to the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which takes effect on April 1st. As those of you who have been diehard listeners to the podcast, we had a recording on this legislation in episode 54, a few days after the federal government had passed the new law. And today, with me to discuss the key points and guidelines issued by the Department of Labor is James Ward, one of CalChamber's employment law subject matter experts. Welcome, James.
Hi, Erica. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it's a pleasure to have you as well. We are still practicing our social distancing here, so we are both calling in from different locations, but it doesn't disrupt the pace within which we've all been working and trying to keep up with what the federal government had done when they passed on March 18th the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. And since that time, the Department of Labor issuing new guidelines and the new posting requirement that everybody needs to adhere to and at least be aware of because this thing takes effect on April 1st. And before we get started, I just want our listeners to understand and remember that right now things are still very fluid and the guidelines that we will discuss today are still changing. In fact, 2 days ago, they looked a little bit different from what they look like today. So it's really important, and I'm encouraging all of you listeners to regularly visit the Department of Labor's website to ensure that you have the most up-to-date information. And of course, CalChamber does do our best to always keep you informed of the changes. And the best way to find the most recent information is on CalChamber's COVID-19 resource page that is available on calchamber.com. And I know, James, you've been instrumental in working and getting the bits and pieces together on our resource page, as well as drafting a number of the articles related to the things that are going on related to the COVID-19 crisis. So on March 18th, the feds did pass the Federal Families First Coronavirus Response Act. That included an emergency paid sick leave and an emergency family and medical leave expansion act. Of course, the devil is always in the details, and since the passage of this law, as well as our podcast and corresponding webinar that is on CalChamber's website as well, a number of questions have surfaced, a number of questions regarding how the new law is implemented, who's a covered employer, who's an eligible employee, what can you tell us about the small business exceptions? So let's just get started with the basics. So, James, who is a covered employer and who's an eligible employee under these two laws?
So, as you mentioned, this law has two basic provisions, the sick leave and the emergency FMLA. Both of them apply to employers with 500 or less employees, and that includes full-time, part-time. The DOL says it should also include employees that are on leave or temporary employees. And DOL also says that for purposes of counting to the 500, they issued in their guidance, the FLSA joint employer rules would apply for employers that are concerned with that, as well as the FMLA's integrated employer test.
So let's talk about the eligible employees.
So eligible employees, there's under the federal sick leave, basically anybody aside from a healthcare provider or an emergency responder, every employee is going to be eligible for this particular leave. And it's going to be slightly different for the emergency FMLA. Under that provision, the employees must be employed for at least 30 days to be eligible for that leave.
Okay, so just to summarize then, for the federal sick leave, you're eligible once you're hired, essentially.
Yes.
And then for the EFMLA, the emergency FMLA, you actually, the employee has to be on the payroll for 30 calendar days immediately before
Correct.
The day the leave would begin. Okay, great. Let's talk a little bit about that small business exception. Can you tell our listeners what is a small business in this context and how a small business can meet the definition and claim the exception? And is the exception for everything involved with this Families First Coronavirus Response Act, or just one small component of it?
That's a great question. A lot of the reporting that's been done on this act as it was being drafted in the House and going through through the process mentioned a small business exception without getting into a lot of the details. So it's important to note that the exemption is for one provision under these leave requirements here. So first of all, a small business is going to be a business, including a religious or nonprofit with fewer than 50 employees, and they can be exempt from providing paid sick leave due to school closure or child care provider unavailability due to COVID-19. And that's one of the six qualifying reasons to take paid sick leave. And under the EFMLA, that's the only qualifying reason, and small employers can also be exempt under the EFMLA for that same reason.
Okay, and then how, is there anything that the small business needs to do? They need to file anything? What type of documentation or affirmation does this, or analysis, I should say, what type of analysis does the small business have to conduct in order to be able to claim the exception?
So the Act provides that small businesses can apply for this exemption or can get this exemption when doing so would, quote, jeopardize the viability of the small business as a growing concern. You know, the question, of course, is what does that mean? How do you show that the providing the paid leave would jeopardize the viability of the business? The DOL, just in its, I think its most recent round of guidance released on this, provided three criteria that businesses can use. So a small business can claim this exemption if an authorized officer has determined one of three things here. So first, if the provision of the paid sick leave or the expanded family medical leave would result in the small business's expenses and financial obligations exceeding available business revenues and cause the small business to cease operating at a minimal capacity, they could claim this exemption. Or if the absence of the employee or the employees requesting paid sick leave or EFMLA would create a substantial risk to the financial health of the business because of their specialized skills or knowledge of the business or their particular responsibilities, they could claim this exemption. And lastly, if there are not sufficient workers who are able or willing or qualified who would be available at the time that leave would need to be provided, then the small business may be able to claim this exemption as well.
Okay, so, and that can be found in the FAQs as well on the Department of Labor's website. So a little bit more here into the weeds. As most of our listeners know, California already has a mandatory sick leave requirement, as do many of the localities in California. On top of that, many employers do offer additional leave benefits. So one of the common questions since we now have this new federal paid sick leave is how does this fit into the pre-existing sick leave requirements? And how does this fit into employer provided wage replacement leave? So sometimes some employers might offer a supplemental sick leave plan in addition to California's minimum requirements. Does this federal leave, is this an addition to, or can it run concurrently with already mandated sick leave requirements?
Yes, this new federal paid sick leave is an additional leave provided in addition to any state paid or state provided sick leave or employer provided sick leave already existing.
Okay, so that's important to know because I know that some individuals were concerned or employers were wondering, you know, do you combine it? Is this an addition to? So we know it's an addition to, but it's only an addition to for those six qualifying events. Correct?
That's correct. Just the six qualifying events. And it's important to note, you know, this act doesn't take effect until April 1st. For employers that maybe have already provided, you know, special leave for any of these qualifying events, you know, schools are closed in many places. They might have provided paid leave for parents caring for their children whose school is closed. Maybe the employee is actually experiencing symptoms or some other qualifying reason under here. If they've already provided leave, it's important to note that employers can't count that towards this new leave. So when this new leave takes effect April 1st, the employees are entitled to this brand new leave, even if they've already taken some other paid leave for these reasons.
Okay, that's a really good point. And just as a reminder, we're talking about, for a full-time employee, 80 hours of paid sick leave, and then that's prorated for a part-time.
Correct. Yes.
Okay, so let's talk about the Emergency Federal Medical Leave Act, because this is a little interesting. For the regular FMLA, granted it applies to employers with 50 or more employees, and there are qualifying triggers for an employee to be eligible, meaning that they have to be on the payroll for 12 months, earn 1,250 hours, and be at a work site with 50 or more employees within a 75-mile radius. Talk to me about FMLA with the 12 weeks here. Is this an additional 12 weeks for the emergency FMLA, or is this just an additional qualifying event under the already existing Federal Medical Leave Act?
That's a great question. Initially, it was unclear whether this is going to be an additional 12 weeks for this one qualifying reason, or if it was going to be worked into the existing framework. The DOL is taking the position on their Q&A page. This is a new qualifying event triggering FMLA. It's not an additional 12-week period. So if an employee has already used some of their FMLA leave over the prior 12 months, that would count towards this 12-week period under the EFMLA.
Okay. So each employer will track their 12-month period. Some do a rolling forward, some do a rolling backward method. Each employer can choose a four. So whatever method the employer uses to track the 12-month period for using FMLA is what would apply here. So as James had indicated, if I'm in the middle of a 12-month period and I have an employee who's already used 6 weeks of FMLA, they would only have 6 weeks left to use EFMLA. And again, as James reminded us, the only qualifying event for EFMLA is to care for a child or a child whose school has closed or a child care provider is no longer available. So very limited, but important to remind everybody how that EFMLA interacts with existing FMLA. It's quite confusing at times. So another issue, this is enough to make your head spin a little bit, so we're trying to keep it simple for everybody. Okay, so another common question that we have seen in the past with leave laws, and of course those common questions come back here when we're talking about this new federal leave law, is the use of intermittent leave. And what I mean by that is, for example, an employee might have a full 8-hour day scheduled, but maybe reports to work for the first 4 hours and then decides to go home sick for the remaining 4 hours. Or if you take a situation where an employee is using family medical leave, they can also use that 12 weeks of time intermittently. So perhaps one day they are out on FMLA leave, the next day they are working their normal work schedule. So naturally, that question did arise when we're talking about the federal paid sick leave as well as the EFMLA. So James, what does the DOL have to say about intermittent leave? Because when I read it, it was quite interesting how they were distinguishing and discussing a teleworking employee, an employee who's not teleworking.
Yeah, they seem to kind of split it up into those two categories. So for teleworking, they take a more liberal approach with intermittent leave. You can use intermittent leave for both the paid sick leave or the expanded FMLA, and you can do so in any increment, provided that you and your that the employer and the employee agree. So, for example, you could agree on a 90-minute increment. You could telework for a portion of the day and leave and return, as long as there's an agreement between the employer and the employee. So for employers working at their usual work site, the DOL's position is a little bit more restrictive. Paid sick leave must be taken in full day increments, except in circumstances of school closure or childcare unavailability. And then it's per agreement between the employer and the employee. The EFMLA may be taken intermittently with the employer's permission. I think this is something that we're going to be seeing fairly common, working parents trying to balance work schedules, taking care of children while the schools or the child care providers are unavailable. So the DOL provides the example of employees working maybe on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then they take Tuesdays and Thursdays off.
So it sounds to me like it's a little wishy-washy in some extent. And it also sounds like it definitely, from the Department of Labor's perspective, it depends upon whether it's paid sick leave or expanded family medical leave, what the purpose is for the leave, and whether or not that employee is teleworking or not. So for employers who are having requests to utilize this on an intermittent basis, take a look at the Department of Labor's FAQs. As it stands today, and we're recording on March 30th, they do devote a couple of the FAQs to this issue and offer some examples that can help apply the situation to what your specific situation might be in order for you to be able to accommodate your employee. And I do have to say on that note, the Department of Labor sprinkles throughout the FAQs this catch-all that essentially says that employers are encouraged to be as flexible as possible with their employees. So that is the basis by which a lot of this is coming from, and something to keep in the back of our minds as we're working through this challenging situation and trying to keep our business and goods flowing while also being mindful of some of the stresses that are being put on our employees, whether that's physical or illness related, or the fact that there are children at home now, making it a little bit more challenging to telework. Okay.
Right.
James, another common question that we receive when we're handling just your general of the mill leave questions, and of course now pops up here, and this is a little more of an interesting situation because part of this federal legislation includes a tax credit back to the employer who is providing the leave as described in the act. And so that means that there has to be some kind of documentation that the employer can provide to the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, to substantiate the fact that the leave was being provided to a qualifying employee. So what kind of documentation does an employer need to retain? And I know many employers are asking, what kind of documentation can I ask my employee to provide? What does the Department of Labor say about that?
That's also a great question. The DOL is not specific on that yet. It's one of those answers that's kind of a moving target right now. What they say is that the employees must provide documentation to support paid sick leave as specified in the applicable IRS forms, instructions, and information. And as of the time that we're recording this right now, I have not seen what those forms and instructions and information are. So it's not entirely clear what documentation employers are supposed to keep at this time.
Extremely helpful then. Okay, so hopefully we'll get some more information the next couple of days, because this is actually, if I'm correct, James, an FAQ that was changed over the last couple of days, because I believe previously the Department of Labor had identified some documentation. It looks like they retracted that and is now leaving it to the IRS to decide.
Yes, that's what it looks like. We can I'll give the DOL a little credit here. They do address the school closure a little bit more detail. So they give examples of particular documents you might get if you are taking leave to care for a child whose school is closed. So, for example, this could include a notice that has been posted on a government school or daycare website or published in a newspaper, or even an email from an employee or official of the school or place of care, child care provider. So those are the kinds of things we'll want to be requesting from employees that are taking leave under that particular qualifying reason. As for the other qualifying reasons, again, we're going to have to wait on the IRS guidance. We can imagine it's going to be copies of a government quarantine or isolation order or written documentation by a healthcare provider if they're advising someone to self-quarantine, things like that.
Okay. As a frequent contributor to the Cal Chamber HR Watchdog blog, are you planning to do a blog when we get more information about the documentation issue?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. All right. Last but not least, I mean, we could talk on and on about these Department of Labor guidelines, but in the interest of time, an important thing for all employers to be aware, there is a new posting. This posting has to do with the federal act that we just talked about. James, can you touch upon the new posting and how employers are supposed to comply with all of their employees that are remote?
Sure. Yeah, the new act, it requires employees to post notice of these requirements in what they call a conspicuous place or conspicuous places. What about the remote employees? Everybody's teleworking right now. What do we do? The DOL states on their website, they posted a particular Q&A just for the notice requirements. They said employers can comply by emailing or mailing this poster out to their remote employees or even posting it on an employee sort of internal, external website that they can see it.
Okay, so that's a little bit different from the other postings that we normally work with that are very limited to, you know, in a conspicuous location that's frequented by employees.
Right.
So they're at least acknowledging the fact that a lot of their employees right now are not coming to their physical place of business. But for those that do have employees that are still coming in because they're an essential business, then they do need to post the poster next to their other postings in the workplace.
That's correct. Yeah.
And then again, at least as it stands right now, everything we've been talking about today, it's a short-term leave. And what I mean by that is, as of right now, it is to essentially sunset or go away December 31st of this year.
Yes, that's correct.
All right, James. Well, this provides folks with a lot of helpful information, hopefully answering some of the common questions that people are having as they are maneuvering and navigating through the new leave, particularly as April 1st is right around the corner. So with that, thank you so much, James, for being our guest today.
My pleasure.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in again to Cal Chamber's Workplace. We are going to see this through together. Please comment and share at calchamber.com.